You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hello, Paul Bloom.
Hello, Robert Wright.
Psychologist. Good to see you.
It's good to see you, too. Where are you right now?
You know, it's funny. I'm in the city of my early adolescence. City by the Bay, San Francisco, where I went to 6th, 7th, and 8th grade.
Are you reliving past glories?
Glory is not the word. I feel the vibe. I mean, where I lived, you know, there's always a very strong smell of eucalyptus trees. And so when you're here, you know it. It's great. And plus, San Francisco has a very distinct climate.
When I hear about San Francisco and I hear about the smell, people do not talk about eucalyptus trees these days. The city has received some extremely bad publicity.
Well, there is where I am, there you see a little bit of the homelessness problem. This isn't the heart of the problem by any means. But yeah, the city's changed in a lot of ways. I mean, it's changed at the other extreme, too. It's like when I lived here, as I recall, I mean, not that, what do you know, between the ages of 12 and 14, but it didn't seem to me like a city that kind of inordinately respected wealth. I mean, not more than your average community. Mm-hmm. It was known as this kind of artsy, vague, just very low key. It was a great place. I loved it, even though it was a wild time. It was like, you know, the height of flower children. I was literally a flower child. I was 12 years old. I was the only literal flower child in San Francisco.
It's hard to see you as a flower child.
I was. The flower part, no, I supported the Vietnam War back then. My father was in the Army. We lived on the Presidio. Yeah. I was not. I was just a child. It was wild, but I loved it. And it just, Silicon Valley now kind of permeates at least, the parts of the culture that I find myself in contact to, where it's all about like wealth and power.
And are you talking? Are you speaking truth to power? Is that what brings you there?
I'm ready to. If somebody powerful walks in, good fucking luck, dude. Come on. Come on. But they wouldn't be at a shabby motel like this, I'll tell you. That's the whole problem. Speaking of which, this is such a great segue, Paul Bloom. Of the Small Potatoes magazine, who is speaking to Robert Wright of the Non-Zero, newsletter or magazine. Perfect segue, because I am here. The news I'm delivering is the oligarchy has arrived. And I'm not kidding. You know, people think I'm joking. I'm not. This is serious, Paul.
So one way to frame this issue is in terms of a question. Suppose you were living in Pennsylvania and, and there was a petition that you could sign that would express your support for the First and Second Amendments. But also, should you sign it and you're the lucky one chosen, Elon Musk will give you $1 million. Would you sign it?
No. Now, he's not quite making that offer, we should say, in fairness. You join a lottery. But he was actually guaranteeing payment of $100 to people. And the deal, it's this double-edged thing, because he's making being a registered voter prerequisite for this.
That's right.
So some people will register in order to participate. In effect, he's paying them to register to vote. When you do that straightforwardly, it's definitely illegal. It's unclear whether this is legal. But also then they get their contact info, email addresses, smartphone numbers, whatever, everyone who signs up. And so that's going to be a tool of at least some power. Elon is doing various things. I mean, if Trump wins, and I'm sorry to say that at this point, if I had to bet even money, I'd say he's going to win. The momentum, you know, they say it's a dead heat, but the momentum is with him. I often don't take momentum seriously in this case for reasons I could explain if anyone's interested. I kind of do. But in any event, I think he has a better than 50% chance of winning. If he wins and he's rational, he will look back and say Elon played a very big role, not just in this way, but in lots of ways, stirring up the Elon fanboys, doing various things. And, you know, what an oligarchy is few rich guys help guy get power. Guy uses power to reward the rich guys. And then he stays in power, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, if Trump wins, it's very clear that Elon is, you know, at least it sounds like he's going to play a big role in the administration. And I would say never before in American history have you had a situation where a rich person who played such a large role in helping get someone get elected president was rewarded so handsomely. I mean, the idea is he's going to be this efficiency czar who can go around, like, you know, telling Trump to use whatever executive powers he has to cut this and that line item, punish this and that agency. And Elon already has vendettas against a number of agencies in the government. And everything we know about Trump and Elon tells us that, yes, he will use his power to exercise personal grievances, which often will be involved things that agencies have done that he found threatening to his business interests. I mean, this is just, if this plays out and Trump wins, I'm telling you, you know, we've been getting more, in a sense, oligarchic for some time, and it's a problem with both parties. But I just think this, we're reaching truly scary levels, if you ask me.
Yeah, I agree with every word of that. It's particularly transparent. I mean, Elon Musk is generating a lot of money, a lot of support, certainly a lot of support through X, his social media platform. And in return, he will be given control by Trump, if Trump wins, of the decision of what government agencies to gut, to destroy. And a lot of it will be directed in ways that will directly help Elon Musk's interests, like SpaceX.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not, and nobody is trying to muffle this. Nobody's saying, yeah, but we're going to take all these precautions to make sure it doesn't happen. It's pretty straightforward.
Yeah. And remember, Musk is, I think, genuinely under the impression that the Biden administration is persecuting him. And that may not be totally imagined. I mean, look, in the real world, there's a reason that, as a rule, CEOs have more or less kept their mouths shut about the government, because they know that the government is full of real people who may, you know, when push comes to shove, retaliate. And so maybe some of this has happened. On the other hand, Elon, I mean, the petition thing is a perfect example. He's always pushing the envelope on the legality of things. He's been punished by the SEC for things that were definitely flat out banned. I don't think all of what he would complain about in the government is persecution. And some of it is just bureaucratic, like people enforcing environmental regulations in this pedantic way that they do. I don't know, but I'm not feeling good about this country, Paul.
So why are you so Trump is a tiny bit ahead in the polls, bigger ahead in the betting markets. Why do you see this as a trend that's going to get worse?
Yeah, well, first of all, the betting market thing, some people think that some of that, I mean, he's ahead like now 65-35 in the betting markets. It's just getting worse and worse from Kamala's point of view. There is evidence that I think the New York Times wrote about, that somebody is playing, you know, fooling around in order to create the illusion of inexorable momentum. There were four very big bets placed, I think ostensibly from separate people, turned out to be the same person, from some kind of thing that's called Kraken, K-R-A-K-E-N. Isn't that a Trump? That's like a Trump word, right? Anyway, some people think this is Elon doing this, but even if you put that aside, put the betting markets aside, the polls have clearly been narrowing. Historically, a Democrat has to win the general vote by quite a bit, that win the actual election, just because of like the way the swing states are swinging these days. But even if you look at the state by state polls, it's been getting narrower and narrower. And people say, okay, now it's a toss up, it's a dead heat, fine. But why has it been getting narrower and narrower, right? Is there, what is the explanation? And is that something that you can expect to continue? And I think a couple of things come to mind. Elon's stuff is working and he's going to keep doing it, I think, possibly. But also, I think Kamala was the relatively unknown quantity. And compared to Trump. And it could be that as people see more of her, they like her less. That's a plausible explanation. Now, of course, they're seeing her. She's being mediated by whatever media prism they're using, social media, whatever, you know, tribalized mass media they use. But still, I would think the relatively unknown candidate should be most worried about a trend like that, just in principle.
So could I ask a naive question going back to the betting markets? Suppose you had the power. Suppose you were Trump, and you had the power to give the world the impression that you were winning. Now, if I want to make a book of mine a bestseller, the best way to do so would be convince everybody it's a bestseller and everybody will buy it.
Mm-hmm.
But how does it go for elections? Like, I could imagine a narrative where people think Trump is winning, and then they say, Harris voters say, I'm going to stay home, and Trump voters say, I'm going to go vote. But I could easily imagine the inverse, which is, oh, we're winning, I don't have to vote, and a loser panics and says, I better get out there.
That's a very good point. It may be particularly true with Trump because a number of people really either really don't like him or really worry about, four more years of him. And you could be right. And it's interesting because I think that's the kind of dynamic Elon would not recognize. I mean, if it's, let's say, suppose that, who knows which billion, there is some reason to believe something shady going on with the betting markets. They are trying to create the appearance that Trump is the inevitable winner. And let's say it's Elon. I think if you look at his whole Tesla and corporate strategy, this is what he does. He definitely, it's like, yeah, just create the illusion that this is going to happen and it will happen. Just keep saying full self-driving is 18 months away and they'll keep buying it. It's worked. I mean,
yeah.
And I think we now may be finally to the point where it is 18 months away. Who knows? But his strategy has totally been about creating the appearance of success. And so I find what you just said heartening. Maybe he's misjudging the dynamic in this race.
I mean, I'd love to hear a political scientist jump in because there must be an answer to this. For what it's worth, on Facebook, I regularly get ads from Obama and Harris and the Democrats. And what they say is, you know, we're kind of losing. We're slipping behind. So, give us money. Give us money. Get your friends out to vote. This is important. We can't coast. And so maybe the people who are, if this is happening, pumping up the betting markets to make it look like Trump is winning, are hurting Trump.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
One of your
many experts you regularly consult with should know the answer to this.
Who is that? Mickey Kaus?
I wasn't thinking about Mickey Kaus, but no, I want to discourage you from having Mickey Kaus come on a show because he makes me look bad.
I have bad news for you. I am going to do a show with Mickey before the election. We are going to do one.
It's because he's a Trump supporter. Comparative advantage. That's his comparative advantage.
Definitely. Compared to many, many journalists his age, it distinguishes him.
Mine's just being Canadian.
By the way, we'll get back to your Canadianness, but as long as I'm promoting future episodes of the podcast, I'm also going to do one with Jeff Morley, who is a true expert on the JFK assassination, and that'll air around November 21st. 22nd, he has this JFK Facts newsletter. He did really important, he had some important reporting when he was with the Washington Post on the whole Kennedy thing. But I bring this up because the last, only a week ago, I was in Dallas and I finally went to the Grassy Knoll. I've got selfies, Grassy Knoll selfies. I went up to the sixth floor. The book depository.
Did you find any shells on the ground that had been missed?
There were three shells. I did. We don't want to go too far into this, but it's interesting. I bought at the, there's a museum in the sixth floor of the book depository.
Yeah.
And they sell old copies of the newspapers and, facsimiles. And the Dallas Times Herald, which was the afternoon, the evening paper, their November 22nd issue would have been just about the first report to appear in print anywhere. Certainly probably the best informed, because it was the Dallas newspaper. Yep. It was in print like several hours after he died. It's just interesting that the report, their report about the sound of the shots, they just quote their photographer. I think the guy who wrote it wasn't on the scene. So they say the Times Herald photographer said he heard like, I wish I had it with me, but it was like one shot and then two shots in rapid succession. And okay, that's what people have said who say Oswald couldn't have fired all the shots. Because, you know, he had the bolt action rifle. They've timed the amount. Paul, I can see you're getting bored. Anyway, folks,
no,
folks, do not miss the Jeff Morley episode.
I'm going to be listening. So, I will say in your defense, I respect you a lot, but another person I respect is Tyler Cowen. I heard him on an interview, and he asked somebody, and then they asked him back, what conspiracies do you believe in?
Mm-hmm.
And he listed a few, and he said one of them was, I believe the JFK story is not, the official story is wrong. I think there's too much evidence that it did not happen the way we're told it happened.
Tyler's also a UFO guy, I might add. And look, both are possible, but, you know.
Both are possible. If I had to choose a conspiracy, I think I would say the Epstein murder. Suicide. The Epstein death.
I would say there's more evidence that something's amiss with the official story with JFK than with Epstein, although I don't doubt that there's something amiss. It's just that there's not that many data points with Epstein.
Yeah, no, I know.
The video equipment screwed up, and he died. You know, I mean, it's like, you know, and I don't know.
I have a friend of mine who hates conspiracy theories. He's very upset at thinking of them. And I got this painting. I found this online. And it's a painting of Epstein's cell. And it's all full of characters. And in it, Hillary Clinton is strangling Epstein while he's being, I think, held down by the Obamas. And I sent him the painting.
I think that may have happened, I think.
I think it's the truth I want to believe in.
Yeah.
So Trump, it's surprising. This is going to be a segue. It's surprising Trump is doing so well in the polls, perhaps getting better, given his somewhat erratic behavior in different rallies. And for instance, one rally, I think he stopped at some point and they just played music and then he danced.
Well, but that was because there was a medical emergency in the crowd, I think. So they had, he kind of, it would have been weird to keep talking.
So he danced.
So naturally, when somebody may be dying before your very eyes, you dance instead of talking, because talking would be tacky. No, I don't know. I didn't see it. Look, I don't know. It reminds me of, I know where you're headed next, right?
Yeah.
I know where you're headed. I know whose private parts we're heading toward here.
And I am not the first to think of this phrase, the Cocktober surprise.
I hope you're not the first. I hope you didn't think of it at all until you heard it from somebody. Please tell me that didn't occur to you independently.
It didn't, but I appreciated it. It's my kind of humor.
I want to get back to Elon on in a second, and it's not unrelated to what you just said. But
you always say Trump. It's not unrelated to this. It's not unrelated to that. I'm learning this is just a cheap trick. You never kind of cash that in.
I'll cash it in. I've definitely got a cock Elon connection. Cock, not necessarily in the sense that a mind like yours, you know, as in mine. But So the first thing that occurred to me, first of all, who knows? Now you found there's apparently serious reporting going on. I assume everybody knows Trump said he was in Pennsylvania, where Arnold Palmer's from. And he said, boy, he was a real man. I'll tell you, the guys, you know, the other golfers, they'd come out of the showers and go, whoa, that's incredible. And by the way, Trump laughed. And somebody pointed out to me on Twitter that I had said Trump never laughs. This may be the first time I've heard him seem to actually authentically laugh. Now, he was laughing at his own joke. It's Trump.
Yeah.
I still haven't heard him laugh at anyone else's joke, but it's progress. So maybe he'll make a fine president. Who knows? He's developing. But I guess everybody knows that, you know, he was marveling at the size of Elon's genitalia.
Not Elon's, though that would be a...
I'm sorry, that you're right, Arnold's. And I don't know, take it away, Paul. What's your take on this?
So I subscribe to Ben Dreyfus's Substack, which is a very funny Substack. And in it, in his most recent one, he promises an investigation over whether this is in fact true, that the famous golfer had a gigantic penis.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to give it all away. You should subscribe to read in great detail. But apparently, there's a story where another golfer is about to compete against Palmer, and he hires a prostitute to occupy Palmer the night before, so that he'll be all tired in the morning.
Whoa.
The prostitute, sex worker, we'd say now, writes an autobiography of her life, describes sex with Palmer, says it was very nice, but makes no mention of an unusually sized penis. Now, this in itself is not
she was just a classy prostitute, Paul.
Maybe. However, but Ben Dreyfus, a lot of respect for him, points out that elsewhere in the book, when talking about a famous celebrity, mm-hmm. she has no hesitation describing that part of his anatomy was unusually large.
And just out of curiosity, who are some of these better endowed celebrities?
Who are some of the what, sorry?
Better endowed celebrities.
Frank Sinatra. Anyway, so Dreyfus concludes that the story is not true.
You never know. I mean, I had heard that he was quite the womanizer, as we used to say.
Yes.
And strange maybe, word when you think of it, but go ahead.
Yes. And maybe one rumor leads to the next.
Yeah. It could just be, yeah.
People are upset about what Trump did and trying to make a big thing about it. And, you know, I've seen clips of, you know, guy from CNN looking all consternated and saying, what's going on here? And everything like that. It's just Trump being Trump. If, you know, if you're upset by this, it's not like it's kind of late in the game to get upset that Trump says odd, inappropriate things.
Yeah. And I think you should understand why this kind of thing, I suspect, appeals to some of his supporters and even to some undecideds, because it says, I am not a regular politician. Everyone hates regular politicians, and rightly so, because most of them are you know, contemptible. Most of them, not all, but really, honestly, most people in the American Congress are without principle, if you ask me. And or even worse, like they have completely warped principles. But so, you know, I think this appeals and you know, yeah, it's like the resistance has not entirely learned a lesson. I think that, like, the other thing is, like, getting indignant, I just think, you know, is fuel for him.
Yes, that's right.
And
now people a while ago when we're talking about Biden, you made much of his sort of cognitive deterioration. Mm. And then I will say, and I'm part of my role here is to praise you when you get things right. As history will record, his cognitive deterioration was real, was significant, and ended with him, you know, dropping out of the race.
Mm-hmm.
People have said that Trump has shown significant deterioration over recent years, maybe even recent months. And I used to be skeptical. You'd say, Trump is Trump. He's not the man he was 10 years ago, but it's, you know, it's fine. He's riffs. Sometimes I think that I've heard clips of his riffing, and sometimes it does get quite incoherent.
Yeah, it's hard to say. I haven't been paying super close attention lately, but of course, he had always kind of been like that. Like if you read the transcript, actual word for word transcript, sometimes like what the hell's going on? Did you hear him? And you kind of know, and people know what he means. So it's not like he's ever been, you know, William Jennings Bryant. Neither Biden, actually, but he was more articulate in his prime than Trump, I think.
Yes. Biden was a sharp decrease. Yeah. And Trump has always had the same style.
Yeah. It's hard to say, look, I don't feel great about him being president for another 4 years. And And there's a lot of things aside from sheerly cognitive things about age that worry me. I mean, there are other things at least. So we're not in a great place. But let me deliver on the not unrelated thing with Elon. I just want to say we had talked about, you know, like he disclosed not long ago that when he was on Saturday Night Live a few years ago, he had this idea for an opening skit that they rejected. And it involved a play on the word cock, and it involved him pulling a rooster, I assume like not a real living rooster, out of his pants. And then it involved, you know, a play on a word for cat and another a female cast member of SNL. And I had just thought, oh my God, it's so juvenile. But now I then went and heard him actually tell the story. And what's striking about it, I mean, the premise, well, what's striking about it is that he actually thought they'd buy it. It was like, you know, I mean, the premise is modestly interesting, which is that he says he'd always wondered, is Saturday Night Live, or is there a 10-second delay? And this was going to test it, although actually, I don't know how it tests it. If I guess he was just going to say that by way of setting it up, but he assumed they would let him do the thing because he thought, since he wasn't going to really show us his penis, see, he was going to, you know, he was going to say, want to see my, you know, cock, and then pull out a rooster. But just the fact, if you hear him tell the whole thing, just the fact that he really thought like they might go for it. Yeah. It's a failure of, you know, cognitive empathy, of perspective taking, that makes it all the more remarkable that he has succeeded in businesses where you really do have to have some sense of what the customer wants.
You have put your finger on a real paradox, which is you and me both think cognitive empathy is super important for getting along in the world, for being a successful leader, for being good at relationships, for dealing with your adversaries. And yet here's a guy who seems to really lack it in a big way. Your example is one. There's a lot of other examples. And yet he's CEO of, you know, a half dozen companies. And by any measure, he's incredibly successful. And even like us, if you think of him as somebody with manifest personality flaws, I don't think you could seriously doubt that he's had many real successes in life where he's done important, powerful things.
It's amazing. And, you know, I mean, part of it is he's a true technological visionary. But it's a little more than that. I mean, you know, he does sense markets that turn out to kind of be there. And then further, he has the marketing thing. Like, it's interesting that he sold 1 billion Teslas. And then people started saying, wait a second, do we really want EVs? It's kind of a pain that you have to charge, you know, and like suddenly people are saying, well, the market isn't nearly what we thought it was. And yet he managed to make it cool.
Yeah.
And you would think that took cognitive empathy. You would think you had to kind of understand where, you know, the psyche, you know, with other things like Starlink, I guess you don't need to have super subtle insight to, you know, you just need to like, look, okay, more and more people want access to communication highways, and a lot of people don't have them. But it's still a remarkable combination of assets and deficits that he has. It's weird.
And maybe it's not purely that there are two sides of him that are very opposed. It could be part of his successes can be due to a certain obsessive attitude that he has, a certain assholeness, a certain high, very high degree of risk-taking, where he's been fortunate enough to pay off.
That's the other thing. You know, there are, I'm sure, all kinds of people who took risks in probably broadly, you know, his line of work. And we don't know, you know, their risks just didn't pay off. But He's got something because he succeeded in these all these different endeavors. I mean, EVs, Starlink, like rockets, and they just, you know, like you saw the rocket that just landed itself, right? On its return to Earth.
So cool.
It's like, yeah. So I don't know. Now, a lot of these ideas may come from other people, but still, there's talent in knowing how to use people. So
and Isaacson says convincingly, and Isaacson in his biography is no fanboy. You could tell at some point he was genuinely sick of Musk and Musk's flaws, but he describes him over and over again as incredibly knowledgeable about engineering stuff.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
And incredibly bad at the human stuff. There's a story, I don't know if it's coming from Isaacson, when he buys Twitter and appears in front of the Twitter board to sort of meet them. And, you know, and his questions, his answers are ridiculous. He's asked, what are your plans for Twitter? And well, to become an intergalactic civilization. And, and he's very bad dealing with people, but very good with machines.
Well, that's the other thing, is he has such deep conviction in such kind of, about such far out things. Like, if we don't, I am the person who will lead us on the Mars. And if we don't get to Mars, we're toast. And by the way, you know what that means, is that most of us are toast, right? I mean, you know, he certainly doesn't think we're going to transfer billions of people to Mars. What he thinks is that the Earth is just going to implode. But so long as we can get, you know, a beachhead on Mars, at least civilization will survive. Well, I don't find that very reassuring. I would rather like focus on planet Earth and get our shit together.
Well, but let's put aside Musk. I've been convinced by people like McCaskill and Bostrom that the way out is for us to really become an interplanetary civilization. And even if I don't end up living in the stars, the fact that my children and grandchildren, great-grandchildren, and so on might spread out through the universe, I mean, this is kind of a good thing.
A good thing? I'm not against, you know, doing a reasonable level of ongoing exploration. It's just that when you hear him talk about it, like, I think sometimes he puts this, what he sees as the government persecution thing, in this context. Yeah. It's like, if Trump doesn't win and I don't become the government efficiency czar, we may not get to Mars. Don't you understand what that means? No, I don't.
There is a dose of narcissism. Yeah. Mixed with all of this.
Yeah. And he once said, and I think he may mean it, there's a 1 in a billion chance that we are in base reality, meaning overwhelmingly the odds are that this is a simulation. Yeah. Like overwhelmingly. And like, how do you think you have a solid foundation for saying something like that? I mean, I know the Bostrom argument, but the Bostrom argument that is only, if you look at it closely, it's only that it's plausible that we're living in a simulation, not really that it's highly likely.
I got a spam email from somebody who discovered a theory of all of psychology and gods and everything. And he outlines the theory in some detail. Each god has a personality type and so on. And he says, the odds of my theory being right are 33%, which is very high odds. I never said how he got to 33%, but I like that. It was under 50. He was like being humble.
Yeah. Well, you know, at the same time, I sometimes get upset when people won't give you an estimate. Like, if you say to a doctor, like, well, how likely is it that I have like this thing or I'll get develop this thing? They go, oh, there's just no telling. And I'm like, well, are they higher than 1 in a billion? Well, yeah.
That's right.
It's like, are they lower than 50%? Well, yeah. Well, we're getting somewhere. Let's keep going and narrow it down.
That's right. And it's, I think it's perfectly legitimate to get to a point where you say, what, are they 35% or 40%? And the doctor say, I can't tell you that. But yeah, any sort of talk about the future, in the end, if it's coherent at all, you got to know whether it's, you know, 99% or 1%. Those are very different claims.
Yeah, and often they do have a number kind of in mind. They just have a practice of not sharing numbers. So are we almost to the time when we bring down the curtain of charity?
The cone of silence? That's get smart.
That, That's from Get Smart. Curtain of Charity, I think, is from Mark Twain, when he says we will, there's just some, what is it? It's something, I think it's in Tom Sawyer, and there's something that, it's just something's going massively haywire. Somebody's getting super embarrassed, and you know it's only going to get worse. And he says, we will draw down the curtain of charity or something, rather than describe the rest of this, what it's obviously going to become only a more horrible spectacle. But that's not why I use the term.
Maybe we should have done that during the penis conversation.
Yeah.
But okay.
Our conversation is going to get better and better.
Let's do one thing before the curtain of charity, which is something we talked about Coates last time in his interview.
Ta-Nehisi Coates, yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And people did not like how he pronounced his first name, which was meant no disrespect, just a bad pronunciation. Just Coates. You and I had a little bit of a disagreement about it. So let's find common ground. I'm going to say something about another interview he did where I think you'll have some sympathy for this. So he's talking to Trevor Noah, and they're talking about his book and about Israel and about Gaza. And Coates says, and I got this in front of me, there's a long description of what it would be like to grow up in that situation. And then he says, look, suppose I grew up under that oppression, that poverty, and the wall comes down. And he said, the question is, would he have been part of the atrocities of October 7th? And he says, am I also strong enough or even constructed in such a way when I say this is too far? I don't know that I am. And a lot of right-wing people came down on him very hard saying, oh, you say you would, what kind of monster are you to say, personally, I would not murder and rape and kill families and everything like that, but you apparently are different. I want to come up very much in favor of Coates. First, the way he frames it is that a full acknowledgement that this is a moral atrocity. He says, am I strong enough not to do it? Is the way he frames it. He says, I am not strong enough not to do it, implying he knows it's a wrong thing to do. Mm-hmm. And then otherwise, he's being an intelligent, empathic person who can realize that if he were in a different situation, he might do something different. I imagine Coates is intelligent enough to say that if you asked him, do you think you could have been a slave owner if you were white skinned at this such and so time, such time? He would say, yeah, I probably would have been. Would you have been part of the SS? And, you know, would you have been a Holocaust guard? Yeah, because that's what people are. We're the products of our environment, and I would have done it. And I think people who doggedly say, only a monster would say yes to that question are really fooling themselves.
Yeah, there's a line in the movie Munich. Have you seen Munich? Steven Spielberg's movie about the Palestinian terrorists at the 1972 Olympics. There's a line where some European guy says to a Palestinian, you know, you're never going to get anywhere acting like animals. And he says, well, we're hoping that if we keep acting like animals, somebody will ask us what made us act like animals. Yeah. And you haven't heard much since October 7th. In fact, there's almost been, speech policing against this. You haven't heard much of, like, what gets people to a point where they'll do something like this? I mean, either you think they're not regular people and they've got some kind of special genes, or it's an interesting question. Can you read what exactly he said again?
This is a clip I'm getting from, an article in Jewish Insider, which is the first thing I got.
Google, left-wing,
He's facing widespread criticism for admitting he may have participated in October 7th Hamas terror attacks if he had been born in Gaza. And here's the quote. I grew up under that oppression and poverty, and the wall comes down. Am I also strong enough or even constructed in such a way where I say this is too far? I don't know that I am.
It's a kind of funnily humble way to put it. Like, it's almost like I'd like to be morally strong enough, but how many people are? It's funny. I was in the West Bank. Now it's been like 12 or 14 years. It was a group of us, being taken around by various people, but including Breaking the Silence, a group of Israeli army veterans who had served in the occupation and turned against it.
And these are the same people Coates was
yeah,
with.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. They do this. They do this. And they were among his escorts at least certain points when he was in the West Bank. And there was a bus. So this is about a dozen of us. Most of us were journalists. And there's one person that people have definitely heard of, a prominent, now more than then, a prominent columnist for a very prominent newspaper who is Jewish. And at some point, you know, she was just taking it in for kind of the first time. I mean, a lot of us had not really understood what the deal was. At some point, she said, man, if I was Palestinian, I'd put on a suicide vest. And I don't know whether or not you could, how literally and seriously that was meant, but it's the kind of reaction, you know, yeah.
And of course, these things flip the other way. Somebody would say, you know, I think there's a failure of imagination to realize that whatever you see as the excesses of the Israelis after the attack of October 7th, imagine that was your family. Imagine you were an Israeli citizen. Imagine somebody you loved was kidnapped. Do not appreciate the desire for revenge, the desire for a violent attack, is to show a lack of moral imagination. And none of this makes us into a moral relativist. We could say this is a shitty thing that people do. That's a shitty thing for people to do. But you've got to appreciate that people will respond to their circumstances.
Yeah, no, that was predictable. I would argue against the reaction we saw from Israel. Then again, I argued against the reaction we saw from the U.S. after 9/11. And as I've always said, Israel, as often as I think they've gone farther than is wise in their retaliations, they're no crazier than the U.S. was after 9/11, which I don't consider a compliment, of course, but still, it's a fact.
But it's an important moral insight. You know, neither of us are moral relativists. You've registered your disapproval of a lot of gone on in the world. And, you know, I think Coates himself would say, you know, what happened on October 7th was a horrible atrocity, plainly morally wrong. But unless you get in your head the fact that very typically, not without exception, but very typically, the people who do these atrocities are not psychopathic monsters, but rather people in a certain circumstance where they believe what they're doing is the right thing, you can't understand the world. You're just constantly gasping and saying, oh my God, there's monsters over there and there's monsters over there.
Yeah. No, I think almost all bad things are done by people who are sure they're doing a good thing. Yeah. That's just the way we're designed. It's just, now we can bring down the curtain of charity.
The curtain of charity.
Yeah.
It's funny we call it the curtain of charity since you have to pay to get behind the curtain.
It's like, well, we are the recipients of the charity.
That's right. Curtain of greed.
In fact, the money that goes to, you know, you can access the next part of this conversation by being either a paid subscriber to the Non-Zero newsletter or to your esteemed periodical, Small Potatoes.
Yes.
But the Non-Zero is published by an actual 501c3, the Non-Zero Foundation. And so you really are engaged in an act of true charity when you give money to me. Whereas if you give money to Paul, I mean, frankly, Paul, I don't know. I don't see the point. Well, you make the pitch. Why would someone give you money?
I one day I'd like to have a house on the Italian Riviera.
And, you sold me.
Bit by bit, I'm just accumulating the money.
Where do I send the money? Is Venmo? Is Venmo
every subscriber counts.
Yeah. Now, sadly, you cannot, by the way, this is not a tax write-off if you subscribe to the newsletter because you are getting something in exchange. However, send us money.
Send it into the IRS anyway. I'm sure it's okay. Just call it a write-off.
I'm very careful. I plan to run for president someday, and I don't want any oppo research.
That's right. I noticed you kept your opinions very, very protective. Nothing would ever be taken out of context.
It's been a real constraint on my expression. So, you sign up to one or the other, and you get to see the bounty that lies beyond the curtain of charity. And anything you want to say?
We really relax. It's a much smaller audience, so we could just say more what we
mean. Oh, yeah. Oh yeah, a lot more sexual double entendres for starters.
The story I told about the golfer was incredibly sanitized. There's much more.
Yeah, now there's another version of this. and then you're back.
There we go.
It's okay. Thanks, everybody. Hope you follow us into overtime.